Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining me for this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. I'm your host, Patrick Farnsworth. Before we jump into this interview, I just first want to thank the patrons of the podcast, those that support this work at Patreon. If you also want to become a patron and support this work, you can go to patreon.com/lastborninthewilderness. And that is really one of the main ways that this podcast is being supported right now. There's no ads, no sponsorships, nothing like that. So if you really want to help contribute to this work, contribute $1 a month or more. You'll get early access to the interviews before I release them to the public. Some other exclusive content there as well, including access to the Discord server. Of course, there's many ways to support this work. You can leave a review on Apple Podcasts if that's where you listen and subscribe to the podcast. Subscribe to the podcast if you haven't done that already. Share it with anyone you feel would benefit from listening to these interviews. Those are all beautiful ways to support the work. Journalist Brian Meir, co-editor at Brazil Wire and correspondent for Telesur English, returns to the podcast to discuss the recent chaos in Brazil, days after the inauguration of popular center-left president Lula da Silva. In previous interviews I've conducted with Brian, I asked him to detail the complex circumstances in Brazil, giving rise to far-right politician Jair Bolsonaro and his victory in the 2018 presidential election. Meir's analysis detailed the well-documented consequences of the so-called anti-corruption investigation and scandal that led to the ousting of center-left president Dilma Rousseff in 2016, the imprisonment of former president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva soon after, which consequently led to his eventual release, and finally the U.S. government's complicity through all of it. When the time came late last year for Bolsonaro to run for a second term, Lula stepped in as a contender and won. Leading up to the vote, Bolsonaro and various far-right actors, many of which are linked to Donald Trump in the United States, attempted to delegitimize the results of an election that would result in a Bolsonaro loss, engaging in many of the same tactics Trump and his cohorts used in the lead-up to the 2020 U.S. elections and beyond. So on January 8th of this year, just this last Sunday, as of the recording of this introduction, days after Lula was inaugurated, thousands of Bolsonaro supporters invaded the Capitol building in Brasilia, essentially copying the chaos of January 6, 2021 in Washington, D.C., in the weeks leading up to the inauguration of Joe Biden. So I asked some questions throughout this interview. Basically, what I wanted to get from Brian was, what are the Bolsonaristas attempting to accomplish? What guides their actions? And why is this event so similar to the infamous chaos at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th.
Is this going to be on video or just audio?
I was wanting to do a little video.
All right. I'm dressed kind of square.
Oh, you look
good. Because I'm supposed to be going to a Bolsa Minion protest later, incognito, somewhere in a polo shirt.
Well, you look... I guess, like, that's what you're supposed to look like. You know better than me, I'm sure.
I'm already a middle-aged white guy, so.
Yeah. Yes.
The polo
shirt.
Well,
yeah, you're like more than halfway there, so yeah. I think you'll be fine.
Let me get the microphone in my face. All I have to do is act super angry.
I bet they're pissed right now, right? They're pretty angry.
I think they're getting frustrated and entering into despair.
Dangerous territory, though. I mean, like when I think of that in the U.S., the you know, Trump supporters, when they get angry, frustrated, it can go in different directions. But we have like guns here and militias and shit, so it's like a little different characteristics there. But
well, tonight, starting at 6 p.m., there's supposed to be, you know, huge national pro-coup d'etat protests kicking off. But I feel like after Sunday, what's happened is a lot of the people who supported Bolsonaro aren't supporting any of this anymore. A lot of people have jumped ship. So what we have left are about 20% of the population that's still backing Bolsonaro. And they're the fanatic, potentially dangerous people who, as you mentioned, in the United States, would be, you know, the types of people who would go out with guns and shoot up family members or school or random people or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Okay. Well, let's just sort of start from the beginning here as far as why I invited you on. I've had you on, of course, a couple times before, so thanks for coming on again. And I haven't really covered Brazil in a little while. I've been following it personally, but I just haven't really focused on it on the podcast. And of course, we had some pretty dramatic events in Brazil on January 8th, which is just about 3 days ago. Something very similar, eerily similar to what happened in the U.S. in, on January 6th in 2021. There are some distinct differences, but overall the pattern feels very similar. So I think if you could briefly, I know we have only a limited amount of time, but if you could, you know, briefly just go over what exactly happened on that day. And then I think from there we can build on the context and like what we can expect to be the consequences of this and so on.
Okay, well, you know, Bolsonaro himself was elected 4 times to Congress using this electronic voting system, the like award-winning Brazilian electronic voting system, which has never had any proven, you know, cases of fraud or anything, because basically the ballot boxes are separate from each other. There's no way of linking them up to a network. So at the most, a hacker could defraud like one ballot box. It'd be impossible to do massive election fraud with this system. And Bolsonaro was elected 4 times to Congress using this system. The first time he was elected, they still had paper ballot. And the first time to the presidency, without ever expressing any doubts or lack of confidence in the electronic voting system, but coached by the American far right, you know, hybrid war actors who have a very close relationship with Bolsonaro's son, Eduardo, you know, this probably all coming filtering through Eduardo to his dad. About a year and a half ago, he started announcing in advance that he was really worried about election fraud, that he was really worried that the electronic voting system could be hacked, and that if he didn't win, it was proof of that the voting system had been hacked, and he wouldn't recognize the results of the election. So, and then he had generals chiming in with him, and he tried to create a military commission to audit the electronic vote. And the Brazil has an electoral court system that was established in 1932 that oversees the whole electoral process. It can create rules for election day. It tallies the votes. And it also can punish people for committing election fraud. It has punitive powers as well. And so they were like, sure, yeah, you can create a small auditing commission to look at a representative sample of the elections. And the auditing commission did it. And even the military's own auditors couldn't find any example of electronic voter fraud. So nevertheless, it looks like between the first and second round, Bolsonaro and a small group of people tried to get international support for a military coup. Yeah. And so he had one person, the president of a liberal party, trying to convince members of Congress to get on board with it. And then his general, Braga Neto, reached out to governments around the world. This, according to one of Bolsonaro's aides who told the story to a reporter from a mainstream news outlet called EJ in Brazil. Braga Neto got in touch with the Putin administration and asked them, you know, if they'd back him up if they held a military coup. And they said, no way. And so then he got in touch with the Biden administration. And ironically, because, you know, the Biden administration was involved when he was with Obama and everything, of starting the whole Lava Jato operation, car wash operation with the DOJ. Yeah. The Biden administration was like, no. And if you try it, we're going to send troops to Brazil to reestablish order. Mm. And at this point, the military completely backed away from Bolsonaro, right? Mm-hmm. So most of Bolsonaro's ministers officially recognized the results of the election. Most of the military people, the army, not only did they officially recognize the results, but they handed over power over the army to the Lula administration 2 days before they had to. Hmm. Some voices in the Air Force and Navy refused in leadership. But basically, we had a situation where we saw this coming a long way off. But without the help of the army, they were too weak to try anything on inauguration day, right? Some people are saying, oh, this was a lot worse than what happened on January 6th. On January 6th, it was inauguration day. Congress was in session. Mm-hmm. January in Brazil is the vacation month. Like most places in the world, you get at least a month's paid vacation in Brazil. And January is summer because we're south of the equator down here. So, Brasilia is a middle-class city. The working class live way out in these so-called satellite cities, 30 miles away, 25 miles away from Brasilia. The city of Brasilia itself is almost completely empty because almost everyone goes on vacation in January on beach holidays. And so these people, they chose a very slow Sunday, the slowest day of the week, in the slowest month of the year, when the whole city is empty, to do their January 6th style capital incursion. So they came in, and the police, basically, we see on the videos now, the police just opened the doors for them, like they did to some degree in Washington. But it was all the same. It was a very similar situation, remembering that Eduardo Bolsonaro, the liaison between Trump and his people like Jason Miller, Matthew Trimond, and Bannon and all that, and his dad, Eduardo Bolsonaro was at the January 5th War Council meeting in Washington, D.C. Very close to these people, you know, like Mike Lindell, my pillow guy and all that. He's close to these people. Mm-hmm. It's obviously something that was based on what happened in the U.S. And so another thing was that without the help of the military, really, what was the situation? Brasilia is a incredible icon of mid-century, like space age modernism. It's a completely coherent, planned city that was designed to look like an airplane from the sky. That's a World Heritage Site because of Oscar Niemeyer. But despite that, it's actually in the middle, kind of like the boonies of Brazil, in an area surrounded by soy farms and cattle ranches, with a very conservative local population and a very high percentage of people belonging to these far right wing prosperity gospel, Christian churches. And so the level of support for Bolsonaro is much higher in Brasilia than it is like in a city like Rio de Janeiro or Sao Paulo or wherever, Recife, where I'm living now. And the governor was one of the most conservative governors in the country and a very, very close ally of Bolsonaro. And so what happened is that one of the few ministers in the Bolsonaro government who didn't recognize the electoral results was his justice minister and security chief named Anderson Torres. After Anderson Torres left office on January 1st, this governor of Brasilia hired him to be the Brasilia security chief and justice minister. And so he immediately took over, another just far right guy, and apparently coordinated with the military police under his command to not resist this capital incursion style event. So after he'd set that all up, he flew to Orlando, Florida, which by coincidence is the same place Jair Bolsonaro is hiding out in. So when the day it happened, everyone's like, where's the security chief? Where's the security chief? Oh, he's in Orlando. Oh, okay. So that then as it unfolded for a couple of hours, these military police were playing the turtle game. They were like, officially, oh, we're trying. The governor was like, we're trying. We're having a hard time controlling the crowd. But all of these clowns in the group were live streaming. And so live streaming started showing up, showing military police officers taking selfies with the protesters, hugging the protesters and things like that, opening the doors inside the government building, just talking with them, joking with them. And the people saying, look, they're on our side. Everybody's on our side. And so when this started leaking, the governor had to immediately fire his security director, who's in Orlando, Anderson Torres. He's like, oh, that's crazy. I don't know what's going on. He's fired. And then after about 3.5 hours of just absolute ridiculous stuff going on. Like, I mean, people try to frame it like, oh, they're just a bunch of losers. They're just a bunch of crazy people, whatever. But some of the people there knew exactly what they were doing. They broke into the intelligence office and stole all of their weapons, their firearms, and a bunch of intelligence documents. They stole computers from the Supreme Court, you know, and committed heinous acts of vandalism against national arts and cultural, you know, patrimony, like a famous painting by Di Cavalcanti, who's a Brazilian modernist icon who created a painting style in the 30s and 40s that didn't have any European influences. His painting, As Mulatas, which is valued, was valued at $4 million internationally and whatnot, which is slashed with knives. You know, they tried to steal the original copy of the Constitution, ended up with a stealing the replica because the original is in a safe somewhere, but they thought it was the original. There were people taking craps, like on inside the building and filming. So very similar, I guess, in a way to Trump-type behavior. But so when this was going on, after about 3.5 hours, Lula was just like, okay, he was out of town visiting a disaster site where a bunch of people had died in mudslides in Araraquara, a city in the countryside of Sao Paulo. And he was like, I'm sorry I have to do this. I was, you know, I've been busy visiting people who've suffered from this crappy, you know, disaster prevention policies in this country.
Yeah,
but I'm declaring, I'm issuing a decree. The federal government has just taken over the security apparatus in Brasilia. We've issued an arrest warrant for Anderson Torres in Orlando. And 20 minutes later, all of the government buildings were completely cleared out of protesters because they showed how easy it would have been if the governor of Brasilia was actually cooperating. Those people would have never gotten into any of those buildings. All it took was a couple hundred civil police officers with tear gas, and the buildings were cleared out in 20 minutes. You know, then they arrested. I mean, I could go on and on with this story, but if you don't mind, I will say one more thing. Then, okay, so there's, this is kind of funny. There's these military bases across Brazil where these Bolsonaro fanatics have been camping out since the election result, refusing to accept the results of the election, praying to Jesus that the military would enact a neo-fascist coup, you know, and kill all of the communists and whatever. And most of them had, they've been shrinking in size ever since, especially since Bolsonaro fled to the United States. And this, but this one in Brasilia still had like over 1,000 people camped out there. And so after all of the mayhem, when they were fleeing the capital and the other government buildings, a lot of them ran back to the camp. And this wall of army men came out with armored vehicles, you know, big machine guns, and formed a human wall protecting the protesters from the police. And so they started streaming this stuff, saying, look, the army's finally on our side. The army's going to protect us. But what they were really doing was like corralling them, keeping an eye on them until the morning when 50 buses could arrive, when they turned them all over to the police. And 1,200 of these people were arrested, streaming like, oh, my God, the army stabbed us in the back. We don't know where they're taking us. And they ended up in this big gym in the federal police headquarters, like waiting to get, you know, processed. Who are you? What's your ID? Whatever. And so then they started saying, we're being held in a concentration camp. An old lady has, they've killed an old lady. And so this photo started circulating of an old lady that had, they'd killed in this concentration camp. And then it took some IE analysis or whatever to quickly discover that this was from photo. This was like a stock photo of an old lady from a commercial or something.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And so then they released 600 prisoners on humanitarian grounds. They discovered that hundreds of them were homeless people who'd been paid to participate
in the
protests. And then there were like some elderly people who they let go for humanitarian purposes and mothers with children. And so they're still holding like 600 of them, plus a couple hundred they took in other places. And they've arrested the military police chief of Brasilia, who was, you know, the third in command in that operation. And the governor, then the governor was removed from office for 90 days pending investigation. Okay. So in all, it's turned out, I think, making Lula look stronger, you know, because everyone in the world, almost all the world leaders in the world spoke out in solidarity with him. I mean, I guess I should stop and let you ask a few questions.
Yeah, no, thank you. I just appreciate all the detailed, like as a rundown, you know, and there's a lot of details I feel like you're sharing that I could be wrong, but I feel like in the US and Western media maybe is not reporting because they just don't have the details, or it's just, I don't know. I think one of the common things that's brought up over and over again in US media is this is just like what happened on January 6th. And yes, there's obvious parallels. There's some distinct differences, but I just want to ask about this one component because you're talking about people camping outside of military bases, and there seems to be this longing for the military to step in and, you know, take its rightful place and reinstate Bolsonaro or, you know, arrest all the communists. Like, this feels like, well, it's a similar thing to what the kind of QAnon conspiracism leading up to January 6th and on that day. A lot of people were kind of animated by that belief that, you know, this great storm, the storm is coming, the military is going to arrest all the pedophiles and communists and whatever, and Democrats and all of this stuff. And like, they were like praying for the military to step in. And it feels like a similar type of thing is happening in Brazil. So I'm curious about this sort of contagion of this sort of, it's almost a constellation of conspiracy theories that are almost coherent, but not really. And then I think as the consequences of January 6th played out, and Trump obviously is not in office any longer, I feel like a lot of people left behind a lot of that kind of framework that they were operating within. But nonetheless, I feel like this QAnon conspiracy theory, it's like pollinated all over the world almost. Like, there's little bits and pieces of it that can be modified for different national contexts. And so I'm wondering, like, how much of the QAnon thing has spilled over into Brazilian politics and informed what happened on the 8th?
Well, you know, the one of the reasons Bolsonaro won in the first place was that he had convinced a large percentage of the electorate that Lula's replacement candidate, Fernando Haddad, had, as mayor of São Paulo, distributed erotic baby bottles with penis-shaped nipples on them to preschoolers in the public preschools, that he was going to create a committee to decide the gender of children when they reached age 5. And they photoshopped a t-shirt onto vice presidential candidate Manuela Dávila that said, "Jesus is a transvestite," you know? Wow. And so they were using some of this, you know, pedophile, they drink the blood of children kind of QAnon type character assassination techniques in the 2018 election. And the big data targeting strategy seemed to be very, very similar, you know, because, you know, Bannon was head of Cambridge Analytica, right? He was like one of the founders of Cambridge Analytica, and they've imported a lot of those tactics. And so what we're getting are these tailor-made messages for different segments of the population. As far as the blood drinking and things like that, I haven't seen anything that, you know, bizarre, that like the Workers' Party eats children or drinks blood of children or something like that, like they did with the Democrats in QAnon. But I have seen situations where, like, at one base, they gave up on the military and they all put their cell phones on their smartphones on their heads with the lights on, hundreds of people, and started praying for a space general to come down and save Brazil from the communists.
Wow.
So there's stuff going on that I would say just as far out there.
That's the thing that QAnon was missing, was the space general, the aliens that were going to come. Like, that's what was, maybe I'm wrong, but man, I feel
Brazilians
like that was
love
really
extraterrestrials
missing.
Anyway. I mean, Brazil's like a place with massive ET sightings all the time.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, it's a theme in a lot of Brazilian music and stuff like that. I mean, I'm not saying all Brazilians, but a lot of Brazilians really like the these themes. So it seemed it would seem to be a cultural accoutrement that you could add to QN instead of brainwashing down here, is adding an extraterrestrial element to it.
Wild.
I mean, either way, it's this kind of like this force that's going to change, you know, that's going to the storm coming type thing. It's just like when they're talking about military intervention, they don't even really seem to understand what that would be.
Right.
They think it's going to be like Jesus riding in on a unicorn, you know, and driving out all of the Satanists from the country or something. Like, that's not really how the military operates.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I know we only have maybe 10 minutes, give or take, until you need to leave.
I can do 20.
20 minutes. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't want to keep you too long, but.
It's just, I could literally get, it's my fault because I was a little bit late, but I could get locked into this building.
I don't want that.
So, but I've got 20.
Okay. Good. Okay. So let's see, what direction did I want to go in? I want to kind of talk more about the, because again, the similarities with January 6th are striking. So it feels to me like this is a playbook, and based on everything you said, it just seemed like all the opportunities for the things that maybe a Bannon or other kind of far right actor is working with Trump in this, like, you know, there may be certain doors that were open to allow for whatever they were trying to accomplish to actually succeed, which is to, you know, I don't know. I really don't know what the result would be, but some sort of coup attempt by the military stepping in, or like Bolsonaro get somehow reinstated. Like, I'm curious, like, it didn't work in the US. Did they think, I mean, how would you know this, I guess, but like, did they think that this actually would work, or is there some other kind of multi-leveled agenda here, which is, it sounds conspiratorial, but what I mean is plan A maybe was what they say they wanted, which they keep Bolsonaro in power. But plan B is like create a massive amount of disruption and do something else as a consequence. I'm curious, like, what you think the kind of purpose of all of this was.
Well, they came very close to winning the election. Mm-hmm. And Lula was leading in the polls by almost 20% until 6 weeks before the election. And so one thing Bolsonaro did was he rerouted $50 billion, the equivalent of $50 billion in government funds, to things that would help him win the election, like lowering the gasoline price. He gave a 50% increase to welfare payments. He brought 1.5 million families onto the welfare rolls 1 week before the election. He, you know, he lowered food prices. He did all kinds of crazy things, not to mention just dropping huge amounts of money on, you know, social media stuff. I think just in like legal campaign funding, he outspent Lula by like 40 times to one. Not even counting the government money he rerouted. But that was all, you know, following a lot of tactics and advice from people in the U.S. And in the end, he only lost the election by less than 1%.
Right.
You know, whereas like if it had been done 2 months earlier, he would have lost by 15 to 20%. So they almost won with their campaign of lies and things like that. But the electoral courts started pulling things down on social media during the month before the elections that violated campaign laws. Like, you can't, legally in Brazil, you can't release a YouTube video accusing one of the presidential candidates of being a pedophile and then circulate that on social media in the days coming up to the election. You can't say that Lula was convicted of 170 crimes and he has friends with organized crime figures and things like that when there's no evidence for this. That's electoral crime. That's a kind of slander. And so they started enforcing that. And I think that made a big difference. But, you know, they almost won. So I think it looks like they actually tried to pull off a military coup. As I mentioned, there's evidence that they actually tried that, but then they realized they didn't have any international support. So it's hard to tell if this thing that happened on Sunday was a plan C or if it was rogue elements of the real fanatic Bolsonaro supporters, which I say, and the big business interests behind them as well, right? Another comparison with QAnon is just this hysteria. Like they all seem like they're hysterical. Mm-hmm. Like they're just like irrational and hysterical. They're screaming on the streets and stuff like that. But this Plan C looks like it was launched without, maybe the military did clever it, but it looks like it was launched without the military. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe, I don't know, but
yeah.
In the same sense that I can't believe that on January 6th, these people really thought that they were going to take over the American government. I don't think anyone on last Sunday thought they were going to take over the Brazilian government. So it seems like the real strategy is to delegitimize. In the U.S., it was to delegitimize the Biden administration, and here it's to delegitimize the Lula administration. He had a beautiful inauguration. People had more foreign dignitaries there than came for the 2016 Olympics. Mm-hmm. He's such a good politician that he got the U.S. and Russia even like cooperating with each other at the inauguration, both helping out with the security, wow. Right? Mm-hmm. And yeah. You know, he's put together this incredible cabinet with some bad, you know, some crappy choices he had to do because of the coalition, this broad coalition that he needs to govern. So there's some conservatives in there and even former mm-hmm. political enemies in his coalition. But there's a lot of really great names. He's left the economy in the hands of Marxists, like mm-hmm. Fernando Haddad, who wrote his PhD dissertation on social policies of the Soviet Union. And he's a moderate within the PT, and you know, other ministries. Labor economist Esther Dweck, who's I think she's even like written or given an interview in Jacobin U.S. before a couple of years ago. I mean, she's great, and she's now a minister of in charge of like public worker sector relations and stuff like that. But she's a young person. She's important that she's got a ministry. He's turned all of the indigenous policy. The three governmental departments that deal with indigenous rights and indigenous policy are all in the hands of indigenous women now from mm. reservations, you know? Mm. And Marielle Franco's sister was appointed as Minister of Racial Justice. So, it's just like, on the one yeah. hand, he respected the class struggle with his choices of ministries. You know, it's not a bunch of neoliberals. And on the other hand, he's also respecting the diversity in Brazil through a way that's still grounded in class and not just like meaningless United States style neoliberal identity politics. You know, so, right. And so this was getting all this positive attention. And now for the last, you know, 4 days now, all anyone's talking about is this stuff that happened on Sunday. So in that sense, it's been a media coup in yeah. a way, you know? Mm-hmm. And like I was saying in the beginning, there's supposed to be some more of this kicking off tonight. I don't think it's going to work this time because they're already coming out preemptively. And they're not going to let... Like, for example, they just closed the quad in front of all the government ministries in Brasilia, because they were like, we're going to do another one tonight. They announced they were going to do another capital incursion tonight. But the federal government has control of the security apparatus now. And they're like, oh, really? Okay, well, we're just closing it. The quad's closed tonight. You can't get on there. It's closed.
Yeah.
And so... we'll see how this goes. But what I see now, Patrick, is this thing. Like, if you look at how people in the Anglo North, traditionally, even leftists, especially leftists or self-proclaimed leftists, treat the Latin American left, it's always this kind of thing like either it's... They call it, Sean Mitchell is a friend of mine who's a professor at Rutgers. He calls it the Chavez-Lula dilemma, right? Mm. So either this left leader, working class left leader in Latin America is making compromises with neoliberalism. He's a neoliberal. He's opened the doors to neoliberalism, or he's a dangerous authoritarian. like Chavez, like Cuba. Yeah. There's no Latin American left leader who ever isn't one or the other of these two things. There's no middle ground. They don't define what the middle ground would be. Mm-hmm. And so for the first 13 years of PT rule, they were, you know, you would read in like Open Democracy, Jacobin, you know, other publications are supposed to be left-wing publications accusing Lula and Dilma Rousseff the entire time of being neoliberals. No, it's true. They did some neoliberal things, policies they maintained. I mean, they're peripheral nation in the world capitalist system that is neoliberal. And they have to.
Yeah.
They didn't have an armed revolution or anything and drive out the capitalists. And they had to do. But to just call them neoliberals is really slanderous and unjust, because you look at some of the economic policies they did, like import substitution, massive minimum salary increases, doubling the money for public health and education, 17 new free public university campuses, and blah, blah, blah. That doesn't really jive so much with neoliberalism. But now it looks like since Lula immediately put some Marxists in charge of the economy, it looks like there's this narrative shift now that they're going to start calling him authoritarian. And Glenn Greenwald's already doing it this week.
Oh, cool.
You know, Glenn Greenwald's like, it's tyranny. You know, how could they punish any of these people? That's just tyranny. What about freedom of speech? Doesn't your freedom of speech right give you the right to take a shit inside of the Supreme Court on a government computer? I mean,
didn't Greenwald release a book recently, and didn't Lula like give a glowing review or a blurb, or like there's some like,
no, I've he seen... put a blurb from Lula didn't read the book. Okay. Obviously didn't read the book. Lula said some really nice things about Glenn when Glenn, you know, very courageously got involved in facilitating these leaks from this hacker named Walter Delgatti. That exposed the fraudulent nature of the police operation that put Lula in jail. And so obviously Lula's like super happy with that. Everyone's happy with him about that.
Sure.
But the weird thing about it is that he only released a tiny portion of the evidence that they had. He only even received like 3% of the evidence that the hacker was offering him. And the hacker himself is like, I don't understand why The Intercept didn't want more. And he said, Glenn told me, no, we have enough that we can like launch an article a week for the next year. We don't need to see any more of it. And there was all this information about U.S. involvement that Glenn just ignored. Like in his whole book about it, he doesn't mention the U.S. involvement. So when he was leaving The Intercept, finally they released Andrew Fishman and Natalia Viana, who's a great Brazilian investigative journalist, they released the stuff about the U.S., but that should have been the headline story from the start. Yeah. It shouldn't have been something they waited until the 107th article after the COVID pandemic had started, when it wasn't a hot news item anymore, to do this big expose of how 18 FBI agents met every 2 weeks with the Lava Jato prosecution team for 5 years during the entire time they were persecuting Lula and coached them on how to deal with the media and things like that and use plea bargains. Like that should have been one of the top stories, not their bottom story. But
right.
Anyway, whatever. I don't mean to sound like I'm rambling too much. But
No, you're fine. I mean, there's a lot to say about Greenwald. He's done this before with the Snowden files and stuff. So
the hackers, you know, is facing a 300-year prison sentence too. So they didn't protect the hacker very well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let me ask you a final question, because while all this was happening in Brasilia, you may have mentioned this already, but you have. Jair Bolsonaro is not in Brazil. He is in Florida, and he left even before his term was officially up. So he arrived in Florida. He's staying at some like MMA fighter, Brazilian, like some guy. Like, so he's staying at someone's house in, I think, Orlando, I think in Florida, right? And now he's in the hospital, but like I remember seeing videos of him on like Twitter or whatever. It's like him walking around some supermarket, just being like a normal guy. You know, it's really weird and surreal to see Bolsonaro walking around a store in Florida, but whatever. So he's there. So I'm curious, like, Because, I mean, there's this weird thing now where, like, is the U.S. giving him refuge? Like, is he just, like, I'm curious, like, what's going on there? And do you maybe foresee Bolsonaro getting extradited to Brazil to face some sort of charges? Like, what's the dynamic there?
You know, legally, he flew in with a presidential diplomatic visa. So,
yeah.
But he's not president anymore, so he doesn't have that visa. So the U.S. told him, you've got 30 days to change your visa status.
Mm.
The other thing that I bet he didn't do, which is even funnier, is that I don't think he did any kind of like carryover paperwork on his health insurance. I mean, I don't know how his health insurance works now, but
yeah,
he's in for a surprise if he thinks he can just go to the hospital and spend a couple of days in the hospital and everything's cool.
Yeah,
his insurance is going to cover it. But the U.S. said you've got 30 days to change your status. So he's got 30 days to change it to a tourist visa. I don't think millionaires in Orlando, Florida have problems getting tourist visas.
No.
You know, so unless Brazil were to formally submit an extradition treaty, I don't know what the justification would be for the U.S. government to kick him out of the country. However, there are wanted criminals connected with Bolsonaro in Florida that the U.S. could kick out of the country, like this guy Anderson Torres, who's now wanted for his coordination of that event last Sunday. And there's this neo-Nazi blogger named Orlando Santos, who's wanted in Brazil, who's also hiding in the U.S., but he comes to Bolsonaro rallies and live streams and stuff still. Like, they could help the Brazilian government send those people back, and maybe they'll do something, because, you know, it's an ironic twist of fate that the Biden administration, the Democrats were involved in starting this whole car wash operation, but now they're backing Lula because Bolsonaro was so stupid that he took sides in an electoral conflict, a political battle in the U.S. that had nothing to do with him.
Right.
Right. So after he took office, William Burns came down to visit him. Another one of the security Department of State big shots came down to meet with Bolsonaro, CIA people. They wanted to work with Bolsonaro, and he was like, no, I refuse to accept the results of the elections. He was the last big world leader to accept the results of the elections months later. And he's constantly just like hobnobbing him and his people with Bannon. And so electorally speaking, even if the United States Democratic Party doesn't care at all about Brazil, even though I know there's 20 or 30 members of Congress who do, but most of them probably don't. It would be electoral suicide for them not to side with Lula at this moment because of the relationship between Bolsonaro. And like, if Bolsonaro had stayed in office, it would have strengthened Donald Trump. It would have strengthened the American far right, because Brazil's the eighth richest country in the world, the second richest country in our hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
220 million people. You know, it's not the size of the U.S., but it's an important country in the world scheme of things to be run by a very close ally of Donald Trump. It doesn't look good. So it's a situation where, like, everybody seems to want to help Lula, to need Lula right now across the political spectrum. He received letters of solidarity from Cuba, you know, Venezuela, Russia, China, the United States, France, you know, both sides of the Ukraine-Russia conflict, NATO, all the NATO nations. So I think he comes out of this for the moment looking a lot stronger. And hopefully he'll be able to move forwards with a really progressive agenda and save the rainforest and eradicate hunger, which are his two of his big promises. Minimize inequality and not have to spend the whole fucking 4 years of his presidency dealing with these U.S.-funded elite, you know, billionaire-funded, basically neo-Nazi scumbags who are trying to destroy, you know, destroy the country, destroy the rainforest, destroy the world, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And on that note, I've got to make sure I don't get locked out of the I'm using someone else's office, and she gave me the keys, but the doorman leaves at 5:30. So
okay, yeah, let's get you out of here. I don't want you to get locked in the building, but I thank you
Although
for the
if
time.
I did, we could do a really long podcast.
Yeah, like come back. Hours. Let me know if you want to do a 5-hour podcast with me. I'll be down for that. Well, Brian, thanks for the update, and it's really good to catch up with you again.
Good talking to you too, man. Take it easy.
Yeah, have a good one. Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. If you would like to learn more about my work, you can go to my website, lastborninthewilderness.com. Everything you need to know will be there. If you would like to support my work, there are a few ways to do that. The first thing you can do, of course, is subscribe to this podcast. This podcast is on numerous platforms, so wherever you listen to podcasts, it should be there. So consider subscribing. And if you'd like to support this work monetarily, there are a few ways to do that. The first is through a one-time donation through PayPal and Venmo. Go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast. Or you can find me on Venmo at lastbornpodcast. And if you would like to support my work on a regular basis, on a monthly or yearly basis, you can do that through Patreon. Go to patreon.com/lastborninthewilderness. And if you support my work there, you will gain early access to these interviews before I release them publicly. You will find other exclusive content there as well. So to everyone that is a supporter of my podcast, however you choose to do that, thank you very, very much. If you would like to leave an audio message that can be featured on the podcast, you can do that through two means. You can call the phone number 208-918-2837 and leave a message up to 3 minutes long. Please let me know what your intention is with the message so that I can then choose to feature it or not feature it on the podcast. If you would like to also just go to my website, lastbornthewilderness.com, you'll find a link at the top of the page that'll let you drop an audio file if that is preferable. And that is it, everybody. Thank you so much again for listening to this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. Have a great week.